From Toronto, it's time for your weekly dose of conservation information here on Canada's All Environmental News Hour. On behalf of CIUT 89.5 in Toronto and our fantastic community radio partners across the country, I'm Darren Kaster and welcome to the Green Majority. This week we'll be hearing first from Naomi Klein. Naomi Klein will be giving part of her TED Talk, which was just talking about the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. That would be the Deepwater Horizon. Talking about a lot of the implications there, she did a, it was shortly after coming back, a trip that she did where they were researching the oil effects on phytoplankton. That's a very interesting talk. Look forward to that. We have a bit of an even more exciting guest in the second half. However, I will actually be speaking to Chris Payne. Chris Payne is the director of the original Who Killed the Electric Car, and we'll be talking to him today about his sequel, Revenge of the Electric Car. I actually watched the movie freshly this morning, and I can tell you that it is excellent. I'm very excited to speak to Chris. So we'll be speaking to Chris Payne, director of Revenge and Death of the Electric Car, in the second half. However, starting off the show, we've got Graham Carey joining us with your national headlines.
Thanks, Darren. Young Canadian environmentalists have challenged Federal Environment Minister Peter Kent and Canada's top climate change ambassador, Guy Saint-Jacques, to debate key points of climate policy and international negotiations. The invitation follows revelations that internal government documents circulated prior to the most recent International Climate Change Conference dismissed young environmental activists as uninformed and underengaged. This stance has prompted outrage among environmental groups across Canada, who claim that this represents yet another case of the federal government ignoring and belittling dissenting voices while disrespecting major contributions that young Canadians have made to environmental causes. A spokesman for Minister Kent was quick to stress that the minister did not prepare the briefing notes personally and does not believe that young Canadians are uninformed. Neither Kent nor Saint-Jacques has accepted the debate challenge to date. Environment Canada has published its annual greenhouse gas inventory and estimates this week, announcing mixed news about the future of emissions across the country. Current estimates put Canada 19% above emission targets set for 2020 under Prime Minister Stephen Harper's 2009 International Climate Change Commitment. While this forecast is an improvement over last year's estimate, which showed Canada overshooting by 29%, Environment Canada was unable to show any improvement in the estimate due to federal government policies. The bulk of the improvement was due to cap-and-trade policies instituted in Quebec only, and changes to the way forests are accounted for as carbon sinks in the country. In the press conference announcing the current Environment Canada estimates, Minister Peter Kent reaffirmed the government's stance in avoiding emissions limits or targets for the oil sand industry in Alberta, despite the projection that the industry will be the fastest growing source of emissions nationwide, growing from 32 million tons of carbon dioxide equivalent in 2005 to an estimated 104 million tons in 2020. Peter Kent indicated that the government is unwilling to threaten jobs or economic growth in order to reach its own modest emissions reduction target. And those are your national headlines. I'm Graham Carey.
Thank you very much, Graham. I don't know. I would love to see some high school students debate Peter Kent. I'd offer to debate him myself, but I'd want a fair fight. So we'll let him debate the high school kids. So we've got, those are our national headlines. We're going to be taking a quick music break now. We'll be back to hear from Naomi Klein and her talk entitled Addicted to Risk. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
All right, and we are back. Those were your national headlines. If you missed them, make sure to go and check it out. Hopefully, I believe that we're able to get, we're still experiencing some website troubles, but I believe we're able to get the most current episode will be up on the website. Hopefully, at the very least, just make sure to tune in right at 11 o'clock next week if you're listening in Toronto and whatever the local time is on our nationwide syndicates. However, we are going to be going to Naomi Klein now. Naomi Klein did a TED Talks last year. I believe it was late 2010, dealing with the Deepwater Horizon spill. That talk is entitled Addicted to Risk. Here is Naomi Klein.
I just did something I've never done before. I spent a week at sea on a research vessel. Now, I'm not a scientist, but I was accompanying a remarkable scientific team from the University of South Florida who have been tracking the travels of BP's oil in the Gulf of Mexico. This is the boat we were on, by the way. The scientists I was with were not studying the effect of the oil and dispersants on the big stuff, the birds, the turtles, the dolphins, the glamorous stuff. They're looking at the really little stuff that gets eaten by the slightly less little stuff that eventually gets eaten by the big stuff. And what they're finding is that even trace amounts of oil and dispersants can be highly toxic to phytoplankton, which is very bad news because so much life depends on it. So contrary to what we heard a few months back about how 75% of that oil sort of magically disappeared and we didn't have to worry about it, this disaster is still unfolding. It's still working its way up the food chain. Now, this shouldn't come as a surprise to us. Rachel Carson, the godmother of modern environmentalism, warned us about this very thing back in 1962. She pointed out that the control men, as she called them, who carpet bomb towns and fields with toxic insecticides like DDT, were only trying to kill the little stuff, the insects, not the birds. But they forgot this: the fact that birds dine on grubs, that robins eat lots of worms, now saturated with DDT. And so robin eggs failed to hatch, songbirds died en masse, towns fell silent. Thus the title, Silent Spring. I've been trying to pinpoint what keeps drawing me back to the Gulf of Mexico, because I'm Canadian and I can draw no ancestral ties. I think what it is that I don't think we have fully come to terms with the meaning of this disaster, with what it meant to witness a hole ripped in our world, with what it meant to watch the contents of the earth gush forth on live TV 24 hours a day for months. After telling ourselves for so long that our tools and technology can control nature, suddenly we were face to face with our weakness, with our lack of control, as the oil burst out of every attempt to contain it. Top hats, top kills, and most memorably, the junk shot, the bright idea of firing old tires and golf balls down that hole in the world. But even more striking than the ferocious power emanating from that well was the recklessness with which that power was unleashed. The carelessness, the lack of planning that characterized the operation from drilling to cleanup. If there is one thing BP's Watery Improv Act made clear, it is that as a culture, we have become far too willing to gamble with things that are precious and irreplaceable, and to do so without a backup plan, without an exit strategy. And BP was hardly our first experience of this in recent years. Our leaders barrel into wars, telling themselves happy stories about cakewalks and welcome parades. Then it is years of deadly damage control, Frankensteins of sieges and surges and counterinsurgencies, and once again, no exit strategy. Our financial wizards routinely fall victim to similar overconfidence, convincing themselves that the latest bubble is a new kind of market, the kind that never goes down. And when it inevitably does, the best and the brightest reach for the financial equivalent of the junk shot, in this case, throwing massive amounts of much-needed public money down a very different kind of hole. As with BP, the hole does get plugged, at least temporarily, but not before exacting a tremendous price. We have to figure out why we keep letting this happen, because We are in the midst of what may be our highest stakes gamble of all, deciding what to do or not to do about climate change. Now, as you know, a great deal of time is spent in this country and around the world inside the climate debate on the question of what if the IPCC scientists are all wrong? Now, a far more relevant question, as MIT physicist Evelyn Fox Keller puts it, is what if those scientists are right? Given the stakes, the climate crisis clearly calls for us to act based on the precautionary principle, the theory that holds that when human health and the environment are significantly at risk, and when the potential damage is irreversible, we cannot afford to wait for perfect scientific certainty. Better to err on the side of caution. Moreover, the burden of proving that a practice is safe should not be placed on the public that would be harmed, but rather on the industry that stands to profit. But climate policy in the wealthy world, to the extent that such a thing exists, is not based on precaution, but rather on cost-benefit analysis, finding the course of action that economists believe will have the least impact on our GDP. So rather than asking, as precaution would demand, what can we do as quickly as possible to avoid potential catastrophe, we ask bizarre questions like this. What is the latest possible moment we can wait before we begin seriously lowering emissions? Can we put this off till 2020, 2030, 2050? Or we ask, how much hotter can we let the planet get and still survive? Can we go with 2 degrees, 3 degrees, or where we're currently going, 4 degrees Celsius? By the way, the assumption that we can safely control the Earth's awesomely complex climate system as if it had a thermostat, making the planet not too hot, not too cold, but just right, sort of Goldilocks style, this is pure fantasy, and it's not coming from the climate scientists. It's coming from the economists imposing their mechanistic thinking on the science. The fact is that we simply don't know when the warming that we create will be utterly overwhelmed by feedback loops. So once again, why do we take these crazy risks with the precious? A range of explanations may be popping into your mind by now, like greed. This is a popular explanation, and there's lots of truth to it, because taking big risks, as we all know, pays a lot of money. Another explanation that you often hear for recklessness is hubris. And greed and hubris are intimately intertwined when it comes to recklessness. For instance, if you happen to be a 35-year-old banker taking home 100 times more than a brain surgeon, then you need a narrative. You need a story that makes that disparity okay. And you actually don't have a lot of options. You're either an incredibly good scammer, and you're getting away with it, you've gamed the system, or you're some kind of boy genius the likes of which the world has never seen. Now, both of these options, the boy genius and the scammer, are going to make you vastly overconfident, and therefore more prone to taking even bigger risks in the future. By the way, Tony Hayward, the former CEO of BP, had a plaque on his desk engraved with this inspirational slogan: "What would you attempt to do if you knew you could not fail?" Now, this is actually a popular plaque, and this is a crowd of overachievers, so I'm betting that some of you have this plaque. Don't feel ashamed. Now, putting fear of failure out of your mind can be a very good thing if you're training for a triathlon or preparing to give a TED Talk. But personally, I think people with the power to detonate our economy and ravage our ecology would do better having a picture of Icarus hanging from the wall, because maybe not that one in particular, but I want them thinking about the possibility of failure all the time. So we have greed, we've got overconfidence / hubris, but since we're here at TED Women, let's consider one other factor that could be contributing in some small way to societal recklessness. Now, I'm not going to belabor this point, but studies do show that as investors, women are much less prone to taking reckless risks than men, precisely because, as we've already heard, women tend not to suffer from overconfidence in the same way that men do. So it turns out that being paid less and praised less has its upsides. for society at least. The flip side of this is that constantly being told that you are gifted, chosen, and born to rule has distinct societal downsides. And this problem, call it the perils of privilege, brings us closer, I think, to the root of our collective recklessness. Because none of us, at least in the global north, neither men nor women, are fully exempt from this message. Here's what I'm talking about. Whether we actively believe them or consciously reject them, our culture remains in the grips of certain archetypal stories about our supremacy over others and over nature. The narrative of the newly discovered frontier and the conquering pioneer, the narrative of manifest destiny, the narrative of apocalypse and salvation. And just when you think these stories are fading into history and that we've gotten over them, they pop up in the strangest places. For instance, I stumbled across this advertisement outside the women's washroom in the Kansas City airport. It's for Motorola's new rugged cell phone. And yes, it really does say, slap Mother Nature in the face. And I'm not just showing it to pick on Motorola, that's just a bonus. I'm showing it because, they're not a sponsor, are they? Because in its own way, this is a crass version of our founding story. We slapped Mother Nature around and won. And we always win, because dominating nature is our destiny. But this is not the only fairy tale we tell ourselves about nature. There's another one, equally important, about how that very same Mother Nature is so nurturing and so resilient that we can never make a dent in her abundance. Let's hear from Tony Hayward again. The Gulf of Mexico is a very big ocean. The amount of oil and dispersants that we're putting into it is tiny in relation to the total water volume. In other words, the ocean is big. She can take it. It is this underlying assumption of limitlessness that makes it possible to take the reckless risks that we do. Because this is our real master narrative. However much we mess up, there will always be more. More water, more land, more untapped resources. A new bubble will replace the old one. A new technology will come along to fix the messes we made with the last one. In a way, that is the story of the settling of the Americas, the supposedly inexhaustible frontier to which Europeans escaped. And it's also the story of modern capitalism, because it was the wealth from this land that gave birth to our economic system, one that cannot survive without perpetual growth and an unending supply of new frontiers. Now, the problem is that the story was always a lie. The Earth always did have limits. They were just beyond our sights. And now we are hitting those limits on multiple fronts. I believe that we know this. Yet we find ourselves trapped in a kind of narrative loop. Not only do we continue to tell and retell the same tired stories, but we are now doing so with a frenzy and a fury that frankly verges on camp. How else to explain the cultural space occupied by Sarah Palin? Now, on the one hand, exhorting us to drill, baby, drill, because God put those resources into the ground in order for us to exploit them. And on the other, glorying in the wilderness of Alaska's untouched beauty on her hit reality TV show. The twin message is as comforting as it is mad. Ignore those creeping fears that we have finally hit the wall. There are still no limits. There will always be another frontier. So stop worrying and keep shopping. Now, would that this were just about Sarah Palin and her reality TV show. In environmental circles, we often hear that rather than shifting to renewables, we are continuing with business as usual. This assessment, unfortunately, is far too optimistic. The truth is that we have already exhausted so much of the easily accessible fossil fuels that we have already entered a far riskier business era, the era of extreme energy. So that means drilling for oil in the deepest water, including the icy Arctic seas, where a cleanup may simply be impossible. It means large-scale hydraulic fracking for gas and massive strip mining operations for coal, the likes of which we haven't yet seen. And most controversially, it means the tar sands. I'm always surprised by how little people outside of Canada know about the Alberta tar sands, which this year are projected to become the number one source of imported oil to the United States. It's worth taking a moment to understand this practice because I believe it speaks to recklessness and the path we're on like little else. So this is where the tar sands live, under one of the last magnificent boreal forests. The oil is not liquid. You can't just drill a hole and pump it out. Tar sands oil is solid, mixed in with the soil. So to get at it, you first have to get rid of the trees. Then you rip off the topsoil and get at that oily sand. The process requires a huge amount of water, which is then pumped into massive toxic tailing ponds. That's very bad news for local indigenous people living downstream who are reporting alarmingly high cancer rates. Now, looking at these images, it's difficult to grasp the scale of this operation, which can already be seen from space and could grow to an area the size of England. I find it helps actually to look at the dump trucks that move the earth, the largest ever built. That's a person down there by the wheel. My point is that this is not oil drilling. It's not even mining. It is terrestrial skinning. Vast, vivid landscapes are being gutted, left monochromatic gray. Now, I should confess that as far as I'm concerned, this would be an abomination if it emitted not one particle of carbon. But the truth is that on average, turning that gunk into crude oil produces about 3 times more greenhouse gas pollution than it does to produce conventional oil in Canada. How else to describe this but as a form of mass insanity? Just when we know we need to be learning to live on the surface of our planet, off the power of sun, wind, and waves, we are frantically digging to get at the dirtiest, highest emitting stuff imaginable. This is where our story of endless growth has taken us, to this black hole at the center of my country, a place of such planetary pain that, like the BP gusher, one can only stand to look at it for so long. As Jared Diamond and others have shown us, this is how civilizations commit suicide, by slamming their foot on the accelerator at the exact moment when they should be putting on the brakes. The problem is that our master narrative has an answer for that, too. At the very last minute, we're going to get saved. Just like in every Hollywood movie, just like in The Rapture. But of course, our secular religion is technology. Now, you may have noticed more and more headlines like these. The idea behind this form of geoengineering, as it's called, is that as the planet heats up, we may be able to shoot sulfates and aluminum particles into the stratosphere to reflect some of the sun's rays back to space, thereby cooling the planet. The wackiest plan, and I'm not making this up, would put what is essentially a garden hose 18 and a half miles high into the sky, suspended by balloons to spew sulfur dioxide. So solving the problem of pollution with more pollution. Think of it as the ultimate junk shot. The serious scientists involved in this research all stress that these techniques are entirely untested. They don't know if they'll work, and they have no idea what kind of terrifying side effects they could unleash. Nevertheless, the mere mention of geoengineering is being greeted in some circles, particularly media circles, with a relief tinged with euphoria. An escape hatch has been reached. A new frontier has been found. Most importantly, we don't have to change our lifestyles after all. You see, for some people, their savior is a guy in a flowing robe. For other people, it's a guy with a garden hose. We badly need some new stories. We need stories that have different kinds of heroes, willing to take different kinds of risks, risks that confront recklessness head on, that put the precautionary principle into practice, even if that means through direct action, like hundreds of young people willing to get arrested, blocking dirty power plants, or fighting mountaintop removal coal mining. We need stories that replace that linear narrative of endless growth with circular narratives that remind us that what goes around comes around, that this is our only home. There is no escape hatch. Call it karma, call it physics, action and reaction. Call it precaution, the principle that reminds us that life is too precious to be risked for any profit. Thank you.
And that was Naomi Klein from her TED Talks called Addicted to Risk. I, however, am Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. You can find us online at greenmajority.ca. However, we are having some issues with that website. There will be links to that. We're going to be getting it out to all the syndicates if you're listening live. That hopefully means that you managed to find it somehow. Please bear with us as far as the website is concerned. However, in the meantime, Green Majority is produced live at CIUT 89.5 in Toronto each and every week with the hard work and dedication of our team of volunteers. We're now broadcasting on at least 17 campus and community stations, which the reason I always say at least is because every once in a while I'll get an email from someone saying, hey, how do I find your show? And it turns out they've already been carrying us and I had no idea. So at the very least, we have 17 stations carrying us across the country from Vancouver, BC to St. John's, Newfoundland. You can listen live nationwide as well on channel 826 of the Shaw Direct Satellite Network or channel 946 of the Rogers Digital Channel platform. We're going to now take a quick music break, come back and have our international headlines, followed by an interview with Chris Payne, who is the director of both Who Killed the Electric Car and Revenge of the Electric Car. Don't miss that interview. It's going to be very interesting. I saw the movie actually this morning, and it was fantastic. So it's going to be a great interview. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. We are back. You are listening to The Green Majority. My name is Darren Kaster. Don't forget, we love to hear feedback from our listeners. If you have comments or suggestions about the show, with something other than asking me when the website's going to be back up, because really I don't know at this point. We're working on that as fast as we can. If you have other questions about the show or any of the content, want to get in touch with any of the guests, we'll definitely see what we can do. Please write to us at thegreenmajority@gmail.com. You can visit our Facebook fan page. You can also check out our Twitter feed. We've had a lot of people adding to that recently. That's at Green Majority. We post links to a lot of the Canadian stories we consider for our headlines there, so it's a great way to stay up to date on all sorts of environmental topics, both in Canada and across the whole world. However, we're now joined by Leah Mazzolini with your international headlines.
Thanks, Darren. The Amazon rainforest is about to get much smaller. Brazil sets its sights on major development in the world's largest tropical forest. An area about seven times the size of France will be used to make way for 21 new dams, a cost of about $48 billion U.S. Brazil's president, Dilma Rousseff, says that this move is crucial to meet the energy demands of their booming consumer market. However, the country's rooted environmental movement has shown its disapproval for the project. Former environment minister and founder of the Green Movement, Marina Silva, says that thousands of years' worth of resources are priceless, and the government is bargaining it for only a few decades of profit. The movement stresses that The Amazon is home to 1/8 of the planet's fresh water, a primary source of its oxygen, and is the foundation to an ecosystem that holds a plethora of undiscovered plant and animal life, as well as tens of thousands of aboriginals. So far, the weather story of the year has been the U.S.'s hot temperatures, and now NASA's new study uses temperature records to make the climate change connection. The temperature data, rather than prediction models, are used to show the global warming is to blame for the recent spell of wild weather. This includes last year's droughts in Texas and Oklahoma, the 2010 Russian heat wave, and the European heat wave of 2003. Top NASA scientist and author of the study, James Hansen, clarifies that they aren't using models or predictions, but hard evidence to determine that climate change is the driving force to cause these extreme weather anomalies. Temperatures of today's summers were juxtaposed to summers between 1951 to 1980. They concluded that extreme heat only covered less than 0.2% of the planet. Now, this type of heat covers 10% of the Earth's land area. In a new book, the United Nations Food Agency urges wealthy countries to change their diets drastically for both social and environmental reasons. Jointly published with Bioversity International, the book, simply titled Sustainable Diets in Food Biodiversity, highlights that over 900 million people in the world suffer from hunger. 1.5 billion are obese or overweight, and about 2 billion suffer from micronutrient malnutrition. These deficiencies include vitamin A, iron, and iodine. According to Food and Agriculture Organization, only corn, wheat, and rice currently provide 60% of the dietary intake of plants at a global level. They also point to the relationship between richer nations and diets rich in meat, dairy, fats, and sugar. The book also claims that the world's overdependence of certain crops are shrinking plant and animal genetic diversity. Furthermore, out of the 45,000 species examined by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, more than 17,000 are currently threatened with extinction. And that's all for the international news. I'm Leah Mazzolini.
Thank you very much, Leah. We're going to go now to our feature interview for this week, which is Chris Payne, the director of Revenge of the Electric Car. Good morning and welcome to the Green Majority, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much for taking time. We know you've got an extremely busy schedule. It's wonderful to speak to you. I was a huge, huge fan of the first movie. Watched it a couple of times. The story of the EV1, I think, is something that and any environmentalist was a tragic film. I think to watch, and I was so excited to see that that you'd done a follow up. Do you want to just maybe just give us a brief overview of the first movie?
Well, you know, I was listening to your international news about the incredible, depressing, you know, weather being changed and the giant toboggan ride to despair that, you know, you can really get on very easily if you take to heart all the stuff that's going on around the planet now. And you know, we made Who Killed the Electric Car was really about how the system that makes money off of all these problems gets in the way of innovation and, you know, makes these problems even worse in the long run. So we made that film. It was really kind of amazing to catch the oil industry and the auto industry in the act of doing this. And the film found a big audience, and I was really happy that we were able to do it. The miracle of the second film is that the first film and people making a lot of noise about what was happening, and, you know, a few other invariables like, you know, the zeitgeist and oil prices, things like this, shifted the world enough so that this technology started coming back. And we were able to get into actually about 7 different companies and begin to look at what an industrial revolution or any kind of technical revolution looks like from the inside. And, you know, ultimately we ended up with a people story about overcoming obstacles. And I was just pleased to make a film in which you really feel like we're headed in the right direction for once.
Yeah, I think probably my absolute favorite part of the second movie. I mean, you're very good at creating the narrative. I watch a lot of documentaries, and that's one of the things I enjoy about the films that you've done. Your best character, I'd have to say, in my opinion, from the second film was essentially the Darth Vader character from the first film, which is Bob Lutz. Tell us a little bit about Bob Lutz, the environmentalist within reason.
Well, you know, I was skeptical of the film, this guy, too. He ran basically most of the car companies in Detroit at various points in his career, and also in BMW. He was a major honcho for a while. Bob is not, he's not a believer in human-caused global warming, although I think if you talk to him this week, he might finally be backing down from that. But I thought, my God, if we have an entree into General Motors, we should definitely take it. And Bob, Bob got very competitive because he saw what Tesla was doing with their sports car out here in California, and he said, why are we not doing this? And he went to his board and decided that he wanted to make the last part of his career, his legacy in his 80s as a vice chair, to bring the electric car back. And so when I contacted him and said, hey, you know, would you let us in GM? You can imagine they weren't very excited about having us come film there. But I think Bob's got great instincts, and as you can see from the film, he's like Don Draper or someone from the Mad Men show.
I loved the character in the photo shoot at the beginning there when you were speaking to him, with the cigar and the gruff look, and try to look scary. And he really is just an incredible character. One of the other characters I really enjoyed from the film. There's two other kind of main characters that really, really kind of catch your eye. One of them is Carlos Ghosn, the CEO of Nissan, who has a very almost ominous feel to him when you're speaking to him. He's described as the Napoleon or the warrior, but definitely a big character. The other one, though, that I wanted to ask you about, we've only got a limited amount of time here, so we'll ask people to go and see the film if they want to find out about Carlos Ghosn. But I want to talk to you about Elon Musk. You mentioned Tesla there. I think one of the funniest parts of the film was when they were looking at in the repair garage, and he's freaking out about all the Tesla cars that have problems with them, and he's going on about, we can't have our customers knowing about this or that that's going wrong with the car. I mean, look at this one right here, and it turns out it's your car.
Yeah, my God, we figured that out in the middle of that scene, and Elon like almost turning into a car salesman there, and I'm like, my God, I just found out that my car doesn't work, and he's going to roll it off the line anyway. Of course, that's not quite what happens, but my producer goes, you've got to tell them. And I said, I don't want to be in this film. You know, I don't really like being in my own films. He goes, you've got to say something. So it's just kind of a miracle we're there. And one of the reasons the characters each stand out on their own, we had a terrific music composer, and we picked a score for, Carlos Ghosn at Nissan. It was sort of like the Dr. No score.
Yeah, yeah.
And Elon, he was sort of the crystal method guy, and we wanted to give everybody kind of a contrasting feeling, so that helps, differentiate them as well.
Absolutely. And as far as the end of the film there, this came out 2011. I understand that you just had your UK release. You kind of leave it at the end there with some, there's a lot of stories still to tell. One of them is that was about Elon Musk and the Tesla company was still kind of waiting on their, they'd just gotten their $90 million loan, I believe, and they were still waiting on the Department of Energy loan for several hundred million dollars. Do you have an update at all on what the status of any of that is?
Oh, yeah. Well, the first thing that happened was there's a lot of political backlash in the U.S. about electric cars. I don't know if backlash is not the right word. It's pretty much inspired from the usual suspects. And Tesla decided not to take a second DOE loan. They did get that loan, and they used it to buy this incredible factory that Toyota had sort of abandoned in Fremont, up in the San Francisco area. They have now, 3 months ahead of schedule, pretty much shocking every industry analyst, started rolling out these Model S sedans, which are half the price of their fancy sports car that we chronicled in the film. And Elon's on a roll. If you watch the Tesla news from day to day, there's like the really positive story, and then someone goes, oh, but there's still trouble ahead. And I think that what he's doing is serving as sort of a catalyst to the whole industry, which is why he made a great central character for us in Revenge of the Electric Car.
Yeah, and people that maybe aren't familiar, maybe they've heard of the Tesla Roadster before, but maybe aren't familiar with Elon Musk. He started PayPal, absolute fortune from that, also involved in the aerospace industry. I love how you describe him as basically the closest thing to a real-life Tony Stark.
Yeah,
it was excellent.
Well, that's what the actor who played Tony Stark said. You know, he wanted they even filmed one of the scenes in the warehouse for his space company.
Oh,
and
wow.
You know, since the movie came out, another thing that Elon pulled off is his rocket ship docked with a space station, which is the first private person with a private company to A, achieve Earth orbit, and B, dock with a space station. So nobody gets in the way of this guy, and that's why it's a terrific kind of entrepreneurial force to have behind electric cars.
Yeah, and I mean, I think in a lot of ways, and I think this is what you were trying to get at with the film a little bit, and by choosing to make him such a central character in the film, was that he is sort of like an indication or like a... it's like an example of almost being able to take the entire industry at all, which is that they've been counted out, and he personally has been counted out so many times on so many projects, and keep like a phoenix seems to somehow rise from the ashes and succeed. So I really love that kind of narrative that you drew with taking him and offsetting him, and there's a piece at the end where him and Bob Lutz are walking around an auto show, and neither of them have seen, or at least Elon hasn't seen pretty much anyone else's cars because he's so been so busy desperately trying to keep his company alive.
yeah, it's true. And, you know, I think, again, to kind of go back to what we were talking about earlier, there's so many pieces of upsetting news about what's going on in the international climate around the environment and around people making a difference in the right direction that I just felt like this is an awesome opportunity to look at some people, even if they don't come out of the environmental, you know, green card checklist or something, that really were trying to turn things around at enormous expense and risk. And that's the kind of energy I think that we need to not just, you know, maybe turn things around depending on what you feel about the future, but to make life more interesting and valuable in the work that we each do individually.
Yeah, and I think that's what was so interesting about the Carlos Ghosn character, the CEO of Nissan, which is that he has something in there where he's not saying that climate change doesn't exist, but he has there's a scene where he's sitting in the car talking about, you know, it doesn't matter whether climate change is real or not. This isn't about Nissan being interested in doing something for the environment. It's that he thinks this will make him rich. Like, he sees an opportunity, and he basically says that customers expect a next generation of electric technology, and he's going to give it to them, and that really has nothing to do with the environment. I think that's very interesting that in a large way that potentially, like, at this point where things sit, you know, yeah. The Leaf stands to be a very successful vehicle, and potentially the least environmentally conscious person of the film potentially may end up being the most successful.
Yeah, isn't that ironic? And I think, you know, his other thing he was after is trying to leapfrog Toyota, because, you know, Toyota's did a terrific thing with the Prius and making a car that goes 50 miles per gallon, basically. But they were very, very slow in adding a plug to cars. And of course, what a plug allows is once you have a plug on your car, you can't charge it off the roof of your house or your apartment building. It gets you off of oil altogether. It doesn't have to be coal. It can be anything else. So Carlos, by taking the strategy that he's going to be the first to mass market with a plug-in car, really was thinking very strategically and taking a big personal risk.
So from the film, I'm interested in your kind of personal opinion after going through and talking to these, and there's the other gentleman whose name is escaping me at the moment, but whose
nickname
is Gadget. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, with seeing some of all the kind of startup failures and this sort of thing, and just, you know, hit the disaster that happened to him. I mean, that was just bad luck, basically, or, you know, maybe not bad luck, as they were saying. It was potentially arson that took out his first production area. But do you think that do any of these characters in the film, in your opinion, have kind of the right idea? Do you have an indication of which one do you think is going to be the company, or at least the mentality, even if it's not necessarily, you know, GM, but perhaps, like, does Bob Lutz have the right idea? Does Carlos Ghosn have the right idea? Which idea is going to have traction, in your opinion?
Well, I think, you know, not to be too banal about it, but they all have the right idea. I mean, Gadget's thing, he was operating without any money. Everybody, you know, we had a billionaire in there. We have a guy who, two people that run big corporations, and Gadget's like my next door neighbor. So when you're not on Olympus and you're like a normal guy working, you're much more sensitive to the ups and downs of what happened in your shop on any given day. And that's kind of what that's his story's about. I think his idea, Gadget's idea, that you've got to take all these gas cars and let's stop building new cars. Let's convert the cars we already have. Pull out these heavy engines that burn all this oil, put them aside, melt them down, put in batteries and motors, batteries that can be recycled, motors that are very efficient, very few parts. This is a terrific future for anybody who's a mechanic and cares about the future. I love that, just as sort of the purist mode. And then, you know, Lutz is right that for most people, a pure electric car doesn't have the range. So you've got to throw in a longer range, gasoline backup engine until battery technology like kicks more power into, you know, a single charge than 100 miles, for example. And Carlos is right, because you've got a mass market an electric car that costs a little bit less money and doesn't carry around an engine. And Elon's right, because if you don't start at the top, then nobody's going to respect you. And if Elon had started with a golf cart instead of a $100,000 Lotus sports car, I don't think people would give Tesla brand as much credence as they do.
Yeah, and how much, just finally before you go, I mean, we've got the idea there that you're just mentioning about Gadget, about, you know, we've got all these cars already, why do we need to be able to building new cars? I, for instance, I actually quite enjoyed my bike ride to the radio station this morning. Do you see this idea of the kind of environmentalists pushing and encouraging the idea of electric transportation as a stopgap to kind of reducing just even the idea of one person, one vehicle? Is this a bump on the road to eliminating vehicles in general, or do you think that there's going to be enough car enthusiasts that kind of personal transportation is going to be here to stay for a long time?
Yeah, well, I have a couple more minutes if you want to keep talking.
Sure,
about this,
absolutely.
Because it's a great point. And you riding your bike to work, of course, is the best possible thing that could happen. I mean, we all don't need to have our own car, and this is why ride share is so important, and, you know, getting public transportation, being more efficient, and working at home, and all these things are fantastic advances forward. The nice thing about electricity, whether you have a rideshare car or a personal transportation, is that it's a domestic energy. You don't have to, like, bring it in from across the world. And B, it's like, it's so close from where you make it to where you use it, if depending on how you make your electricity. And what the oil companies don't tell you, for example, and we tried desperately to put this in a movie, but it just would make it, I kept making the movie clunky, so I had to take it out, was that the oil industry uses a tremendous amount of electricity to make gasoline. And that's how you get crude oil into, you know, octane 89 or whatever. It just takes a lot of power. If you just took that same amount of power and put it right into the battery of your car, you'd go like 20 miles on a gallon. Mm-hmm. So there's all these economics of efficiency that electricity bring to the equation. And I know that for a while the electric car really got tripped up because some environmental groups said, it's just a different kind of fossil fuel, but it's not. And that's why I think for cars it's such a great step forward.
Well, that was a great point that was made right at the end of the film as well about how this was the only technology that essentially got cleaner the longer you owned it. And I think that's a really important kind of step there, is that the cars themselves, because they're based on electricity, are essentially, once you've built the car, only as dirty as the energy that's being fed into it. So as we also continue to clean up grids and transfer to renewable energy, that these cars literally do become cleaner as time goes by. And I think that's one of the most important points to kind of make about this technology.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. The older the truck gets on the thing, I mean, this is why I live in Los Angeles and I see super cool looking cats in their 67 Mustang driving by, and I go, that is probably the best looking car on the street here, but it's the biggest polluter because a lot of the gasoline isn't burned. So older gas cars just get dirtier and dirtier.
Yeah, we have. I actually have Ari Rabinovich, one of my producers, as well in the studio. And him and I went to the Canadian Auto Show, and we actually got to test drive the Nissan Leaf. And Ari, I don't know if you want to jump in here for a second and just, but I mean, I was quite impressed with the Nissan Leaf, actually.
Yeah, it was impressive how it drove. It did feel kind of like a golf cart with leather seats. And I enjoyed the way it drove, and it was really hard to imagine, in the short term, such a vehicle taking over as far as the norm. But I think we do have a little bit of a way to go to make the electric car the commonplace and phase out the combustion engine as the odd man out. But it's definitely a step in the right direction. I think we've come a long way. And I remember when I first saw Who Killed the Electric Car, and there wasn't a single electric car on the road. In fact, the Prius was still a new thing, and people were questioning if it was going to last. So we definitely come a long way, and I think that's where the sequel now comes in. It's like, look how we're doing, and, you know, we're headed in the right direction.
Yeah. I think one of the things... Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Chris.
We bought at the end of that movie, I traded in my other cars, and we bought a Leaf and a Volt, and just so that we could have, when we did press over the next year or so, we could have feedback on that car. And my girlfriend loves that Leaf. In fact, we both do. It's a really capable highway car. You're right, it's lighter than your average gas car, although the batteries give it a certain kind of weight. But we've kind of really been impressed by that car. The Volt is a heavier car, and it feels more like a car. But I think that the more people that get in and try these things, it will be, trying something is a lot more powerful than theorizing about it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the impressions, I think Ari would agree with me on this, but one of the impressions we got when we visited the auto show, we were going around, we talked to as many of the CEOs or higher representatives of the various Canadian or the companies that were selling in Canada when we were there. And the impression, I think, Ari, you'll tell me if you agree, but the impression there was that there was definitely a wide range of, commitment. For instance, we spoke to some people. We're not funded by any of them, and neither is the radio station, so I can go ahead and say names. The representative from Ford, for instance, seemed very, very fake about the whole thing. This was definitely them trying to jump on the bandwagon, whereas other companies really impressed us and surprised us with, once they learned that we were knowledgeable on the topic, they really they took away their kind of PR talk and immediately started discussing this technology as if they really knew what they were doing. From your opinion, from the research that you've been doing, do you find that a lot of the folks involved in the industry are really committed in the way that Elon Musk is, or are the majority more close to Carlos Ghosn?
Or Bob Lutz. You know, Bob Lutz saw the Volt and the electric car as a marketing thing, is the most powerful aspect of it from a sell point of view for the company. It's like, oh, we're like Toyota. We did something green. Here's our plug-in electric car, and we're only going to make several thousand of them a year. And I think Ford, to a certain extent, a lot of the car companies have been really hedging their bet by saying it's a marketing, by using it as kind of a marketing play in the short term, because they can't make the $3,000 margin they can off of a gas car they've been making for 100 years. So they're kind of going slowly. They don't want to get left too far behind, but they're not. There's a consequence of that is that the cars they are making are usually very high quality because they're making them in sort of limited batches. Mm-hmm. And but Elon's totally committed. Now, admittedly, he's only making 5,000 of these Model S's in this first year. So this is all sort of early times. But the more people that support the car companies, you know, as much as we all hate them on some level, and say, no, this is the kind of car we want you guys making, their boardrooms understand that. And that's why the federal incentives that states and counties and are putting in place really help a lot.
Yeah. I'm afraid we're running out of time here, Chris, but I thought a great place to leave it was a quote that I specifically wrote down when I watched it because I absolutely loved it. It's a scene from the movie when Bob Lutz, near the end of the film, is going into a boardroom and they're showing this is after the financial collapse and after GM had to be bailed out. And when they showed their kind of side, you mentioned their kind of like more humiliteous, I'm not even sure what the word would be, the smaller lunches and whatnot. And one of the characters says, there's time for a little humility, and someone else says, if you have not now, when? And I think that's a good statement to kind of leave as far as the entire environmental kind of idea around, you know, consumption and personal vehicles and cars and transportations, you know, as humanity. I don't think he realized how profound that comment was. You know, it's time for a little humility. If not now, when?
Yeah, and that we filmed that scene practically the day they went bankrupt, and that was like their inner boardroom, and that's the quote they came up with, and it's a great quote for the times we live in. It's a very well said, so I can see why you're the host of that show.
Oh, thanks very much. If there's a third film, can I pitch you on air now? I'll get you on record to say that maybe that should be the title. Time for a little humility. If not now, when?
If not now, when? That might be it.
Sure. All right,
hey, thanks for having me on, guys.
Thank you so much, Chris Payne. And again, the films are excellent. If you didn't catch Who Killed the Electric Car, or perhaps you didn't see Revenge of the Electric Car, go to revengeoftheelectriccar.com. There's some trailers on there, and I actually watched it through Netflix, so we're not funded by them either, but if you have Netflix, you can go ahead and find it on there. Absolutely fantastic, compelling documentary. Thanks very much again to Chris Payne for joining us. Ari, however, we've got 2 or 3 minutes here left. Yeah, about 2 or 3 minutes. And I just wanted to say, you said you were thinking about buying a new vehicle soon. Are you going to be making an electric vehicle?
Yeah, here is the one thing I wanted to comment on regarding that is I'm looking into getting a car soon for work. And I know that Ryan, our technical producer, is also looking into buying a car. And I'm not sure if his thoughts are the same, but in a perfect world, I'd like to be able to invest in something a little greener, ideally the Leaf or some sort of a Prius or any kind of hybrid car. But it's such a paradox because it seems the younger people, like the Generation Yers, are the ones who you know, are most interested in helping the environment, but we can't afford it on our wages. It's only the upper class that can really afford them because they are considered a premium car. And there's the used ones that come out on the market are still way higher than we're able to afford. So we have no chance of affording anything else except the traditional combustion engine, which are, you know, going way down in value. And that is a good way to look at it in some ways, is that the electric cars have a higher value over a long period of time, but the combustion engines, you know, nearly go down by half after the first year or two. So it's a shame that I'm going to have to buy a combustion engine because I really don't have a choice. I do need a car, but I can't afford the hybrid that I want or the electric vehicle that I want. And so I've got to deal with it. And it's a shame. There should be some sort of incentive. Ryan, anything about
that? As well, because I've been following, I guess, hybrids and electrics for years, especially after I saw Who Killed the Electric Car. I'm like, okay, this is where it has to go. And it's almost feeling like dealerships are hiding the electric cars. I go in to see the Nissan Leaf. They don't have any. I went to like 15 dealerships across Ontario and none of them keep it in stock. Nobody keeps like the Mitsubishi Electric in stock. It's, oh, you have to do it online and then they'll send you one. So you have to fully commit just to test drive or even touch the vehicle.
Yeah. Tesla Roadster companies had to put, or customers had to put down $50,000 deposits that many of them, after like 2 years of waiting, didn't even know if they were ever going to get it back. So
exactly. Yeah, well, they say it's fully refundable, but
if the company goes bankrupt, then they weren't getting their money back. You know, so, but I think that's a great place to wrap up the show, because hey, if they hadn't killed the EV1 from the first movie, we may have had affordable electric cars now. But no point in trying to play hindsight and remorse on that one. That is all the time we have for this week, however. Thanks again to Naomi Klein, for, without her knowledge, but thanks to the fair shang rules of YouTube allowing us to play her thing this morning for in the first half, and then of course again to Chris Payne, director of Who Killed the Electric Car and Revenge of the Electric Car, the second half. That is all the time we have for today, however. Technical production today was by Ryan Knight. Web hosting and bandwidth for our podcast is provided by the web consulting firm rjgcreative.com, with web production by Arlie Crawford. You can get an audio copy of today's program or transcripts of our news headlines. Actually, no, you can't right now. You can get an audio copy of the program, but not the headlines.
In a perfect world.
For the time being, you can't get the headlines, but our show is up at greenmajority.ca, or a link to it rather. You can send us an email as well at thegreenmajority@gmail.com. We love hearing from our listeners. That is all the time for we have, though. Thank you very much. Once again, I'm Darren Kaster, and that's it for today's live edition of The Green Majority. Until next week, thanks for listening.